Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. The next time you're in a market, take a new look at the produce section. Carrots, for instance. They're chilled in displays that are powered by electricity, and they're wrapped in petroleum-based plastic. Basically, what those grocers are doing are attempting to duplicate what a root cellar has been doing for ages. Now, a root cellar is a space with low temperatures and high humidity. It's where you can stash a winter's worth of food on the cheap. It could be an insulated mound of dirt in the backyard, or it could be a closet in your apartment. Well, there's more from the lost arts of eating well, so stick around for this hour on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, today we're going to take some new looks at old ideas like the pie phobia that has terrorized so many cooks. Melissa Clark is going to dash the fears and ease things for us. We look at how the ideas of a man who was a culinary powerhouse 40 and 50 years ago are still working daily in our lives. We've got the story of Craig Claiborne. And then there's how a food historian sees our newest trends. Now, Ken Albala's caught on to the hitch in the cook our own food and save money movement. Those labor-saving devices that we're using, they cost serious cash. Now, Ken doesn't want to save our labor. He's taking a different tack from a completely different perspective. You see, Ken's a history professor, and he's written a good deal about culinary history. And the man cooks. A lot. Well, he's co-authored The Lost Art of Real Cooking, Discovering the Pleasures of Traditional Food, One Recipe at a Time. Ken, it has been a long time since we've talked. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me back.
So the deal here is no machines, right?
Well, I'm against machines in the kitchen in general, partly because, as you said, they cost a lot of money and they take up a lot of space. But I think they're generally unnecessary. I've never owned a food processor. I like using my knife. I don't have a meat grinder, although I make sausages and salami all the time. And I think people become dependent on their machines, which don't always work very well, you know?
You know, the other thing is you don't write recipes the way we are used to seeing recipes with the list of the ingredient and the instructions.
Well, this is one of my odd pet peeves. I've always found that I'm moving from the beginning where the list of ingredients is listed to the bottom. And I think unless you're really cooking on a large scale, the sort of mise en place that you'd need to have all of your ingredients set out first, I'd much rather read prose, which is the way recipes were always written up until, you know, about a century ago. And I think it's just easier to follow. And the other reason is, you know, sometimes you're cooking for two, sometimes for four. And I think recipes should really be adaptable so that you can, you know, cook intuitively, enjoy yourself and not have to worry, oh, I'm using a quarter teaspoon of this spice and not an eighth, or, oh, I'm missing this ingredient. I have to run out to the store now. And I think most cookbooks really limit people. And I think a lot of people really never learn to cook because they slavishly follow those recipes. So I thought loosening up would just be a fun way to approach this. I'm frankly surprised the publisher let us get away with it. But and my ultimate goal is really just to teach people, to get them in the kitchen, to have fun. And, you know, my inspiration, very interestingly, comes from a 16th century cookbook by Bartolomeo Scappi. And he is the sort of author who will say, here's an ingredient. If you want to roast it, try that. It also works this way. If you if you braise it, you know, use prosciutto. Or if you don't have that, try these spices. And he really sort of opens up the possibilities for cooking. And when you walk away from the text, you think, oh, now I know what to do with this ingredient.
He was a very classy cook, too. He cooked for a couple of popes.
Yeah, he most certainly did.
He didn't fool around. This wasn't somebody who just kind of had a vague idea. He knew what he was doing.
Well, this is right.
I want to talk to you about fermentation because you say this is where something else does all the work for you.
This is right. Well, what I've come to discover is that the bacteria that live in any particular place are different from other places. And I think when we're talking about the expression of terroir, you know, or local flavors, you really don't get those when you're using a bacterial starter or you're using yeast from a little, you know, Fleischmann's packet or something like that. You're getting an industrial product, ultimately. And yeast and bacteria are not exactly wild. I mean, they've sort of been interacting with us for millennia, really.
Uh-huh.
They live in our guts, and we have this attitude in Western culture that bacteria are the enemy. We need to kill them all, destroy everything, you know, by sanitizing the surface. And I think you really lose a lot of the local flavor in doing that. Let me give you an example is bread. Most people, when they bake bread, and I've been doing it like this for years, you buy a yeast packet, you pour it into, you know, the warm water,
right.
You get it started bubbling, you add flour, and it makes an okay pizza dough. It makes a really boring bread, as far as I'm concerned, because it rises so quickly that the flavors really don't have a chance to develop. So on a whim, I bought a handful of cookbooks that were about bread baking, some really good ones, which have meticulous instructions for how to do a starter, how to feed it three times a day. And I thought, I don't have the patience for this. And doesn't sound like fun to me, really. Mm-hmm. So I just put out a bowl of flour and water on the counter, fed it every day with a little more flour, a little more water. And after about 2 weeks, it was strong enough to raise bread. And it was a revelation. I mean, serious crust, wonderfully big open holes, lovely crunch to the whole bread, and I've been hooked ever since then. I think it's magical, and it really is inexpensive. It's easy. You just have to have the patience to let it rise for 6 or 8 hours.
All right, but now wait, I've got a question here. So you're saying flour, water, bowl, counter, no cover, right?
That's right.
And it's collecting the yeast that just live in your house.
That's right. And it's on the flour also. And I think the other really important thing is the bacteria. We're talking lactobacillus bacteria. So it's akin to sourdough, but where I live in the Central Valley where it's very hot. So it's a different bacteria and yeast than you get in, say, San Francisco. But it's really nice sour bread. And these things, after a few weeks, they find a balance between each other. The sourness kills off any possible mold that would grow on it. The yeast start bubbling, you know, every time you feed them about 5 or 6 hours later, mm-hmm. You can see they're really happy and well-fed, and that's the time to bake with them.
And so then what do? You take some of that, you mix it with flour and a little more water and salt, and
that's right.
And then you're
that's
making
it.
Your bread.
That's absolutely it. And a couple of little tricks along the way. You know, having a breadstone is very useful. I use a little broodform, which is a willow basket, which essentially you put the bread in to rise, and it makes this nice spiral pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Slashing the bread is really important to let it rise. But those are simple tricks. Those are nothing, you know, difficult at all.
Yeah.
It's really just the patience of letting the natural bacteria and yeast work on the bread and then have the time to do that.
May those little bacteria just flourish. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Ken Albala is co-author of The Lost Art of Real Cooking. Now, you can find the section of his book on bread and wild starters on our website, splendidtable.org. Now, talking about lost arts, I've been thumbing through the Complete Root Cellar book. It's co-authored by Steve Maxwell. Now, the root cellar is how people used to cash in on food in season and stash it away for winter. I think it's a pretty great DIY project. I mean, all you need is a cool, moist space, and that could really be anything from a mound of dirt in your backyard to a closet that you rig, or if you really do have a cellar, an area that you set aside. Now, of course, freezing is how most of us save for the future, even if it's the lean cuisine that we stash for Monday night. Now, there's another book, Dana Jacoby's Cooking and Freezing, and I think it's golden. You see, she's got a new approach. Dana works backwards. And by that, I mean that she's figured out how to gently adjust recipes while we're cooking so that they taste a lot better after freezing. Well, I'm going to put both books up on the website. Take a look at the Complete Root Cellar book by Steve Maxwell and Cooking and Freezing by Dana Jacoby. And by the way, we're going to also add her rule-breaking recipe for creamy mushroom sauce. And if this tastes a little bit like that sauce in a can, know that it was intentional. Anyway, you can find it all, splendidtable.org. back when the dinosaurs walked the earth and local was just geography rather than a value judgment, there was Jane and Michael Stern. Well, now, as then, they track down the best in hometown eats and they post their finds on their road food site. And they come by to tell us. Jane, Michael, good to have you back, guys. What's the latest find?
We have been in and around Akron, Ohio, looking primarily for the great Central and Eastern European food that they have there in restaurants and bakeries and meat markets. But we found an interesting place that has several claims to fame. One is that they invented the hamburger. The other
really?
Is they invented the ice cream cone. And the third is that they invented Cracker Jack.
I thought they also invented sauerkraut balls.
No. Akron invented sauerkraut balls. We don't know who.
Oh, I see.
This one particular restaurant, Menchus Brothers, which has two branches in and around Akron, invented all three of those things. So they say.
Absolutely. Okay.
Actually, their story about the genesis of the hamburger is a pretty believable one. It happened at the Erie County Fair in New York in 1885. The Menchus Brothers were there. They ran out of chopped pork, so they made beef or whatever. It sounds pretty believable. I don't know. But the fact is, we're not here to talk about the hamburger, which was okay, nothing special.
Right.
Nor the ice cream cone, nor the Cracker Jack. We're here to talk about a unique specialty we found there, which is kind of tangentially related to our hunt for Eastern and Central European food, and that is a pizza that they make there.
Wait a minute. Hold it. I don't think anybody in Central Europe heard the word pizza. I don't know. Maybe since the Romans tramped through.
I think we're annoying Lynn's Italian knowledge.
I have a feeling that the Verace Pizza Napolitana.
The real pizza of Naples, yeah.
Yes, the real pizza of Naples people would probably not put their blessing on the pierogi pizza that Menchus Brothers makes.
Okay, you've got to describe this.
Okay, well, it's, you know, I have had thinly sliced potatoes on a pizza. Sally's in New Haven does that with little rosemary, garlic, grated cheese. It's a wonderful idea.
Yeah.
But at Menchus Brothers, they're not thinly sliced potatoes. They are like mashed potatoes, serious, heavy mashed potatoes like you would expect
like
in a
pierogi. Right.
Along with onions that are sautéed very limp and kind of very buttery, just like you'd get in a pierogi. And also some kind of cheese. I can't remember what.
I think it's provolone and cheddar. And big wads of bacon, if I remember,
yes.
And sour cream on top of
all of it. Yeah, the sour cream is the garnish for your pizza.
It's sort of like a pierogi / stuffed potato on a pizza. I really have a trouble.
You know, I'm laughing, and I should be scandalized, but the combination really sounds good.
Well, you know, people who invent the hamburger, Cracker Jacks, and ice cream cones have a right to do anything they want on a pizza crust, don't you think?
I think so, but all right, so how does it taste?
If you're not expecting like a real, you know, Neapolitan pizza or even a pseudo-Neapolitan pizza, it's kind of an interesting dish. I mean, it has none of the balance that you would get in like a, you know, pizza margarita or something like that.
But it's just, say the very least, rib sticking.
It is rib sticking, and it's a wonderful combination of tastes. Let's just say it's a really interesting local dish.
Like in the middle of winter in Akron, when the ice is blowing, the snow is blowing, this might be exactly what you need if you don't plan on eating for the next 6 months after that.
What do they charge for this extravaganza?
No more than a regular like sausage pizza. I think like the pizza for two that we had, which is actually enough for six, was like maybe $12, $15.
Huh.
It's a very colorful place with a lot of historical pictures on the wall showing the Menchus brothers.
Inventing things.
Like fire, water.
But, yeah. Right, and the wheel too.
You know, it's a wonderfully...
It's
all
exuberant.
American.
Let's say it's an exuberant restaurant.
And I'm sure if you asked, they would throw some sauerkraut balls on top of the pizza.
Yes, they do have sauerkraut balls there, but as an appetizer.
I like this a lot. Thank you, guys.
All right, Lynn. Bye-bye.
Jane and Michael Stern are the minds and the mouths behind roadfood.com. You can check out their finds at splendidtable.org. And while you're there, get in on all the free stuff. Download our podcasts, including our newest based on our new book, How to Eat Weekends. Check out our recipe collection, sign up for our e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and get registered for our monthly book giveaway. This month, it's Jacques Pepin's newest Essential Pepin. You can find it all at splendidtable.org. Well, we're going to be back in a moment with the improvisational pies of autumn. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, it's pie season. In fact, it's always pie season for me. But pie terrorizes people. The fear of failure runs wild, except with a few hardy souls, like New York Times food columnist Melissa Clark. She takes on pies big time, in more ways than one. Melissa, welcome back.
Great to be here.
All right, girl, what are you doing publishing a recipe for a 20-ingredient apple pie?
I know, it sounds like a lot. You know, it's something that started when I was a kid. My sister and I loved to bake, and we would want to bake a pie, and we would go through the cabinets in the kitchen and take down anything that looked good. We'd put chocolate chips in there, we'd put dried fruit and nuts, and we just decided we'd throw as many ingredients as we could into a pie crust, and we called it our 20-ingredient pie. And that's where the whole idea started.
All right, but now this pie is apple and pear and raisin and cranberry and rum and all kinds of stuff. You improvised it originally, right?
Yes. And, you know, it's interesting because a lot of people don't realize that you can improvise with a pie. People think when they're baking, they have to follow the recipe, but not with pies, especially fruit pies. All you need to know is how many cups of filling. And for a fruit pie, you want to have anywhere between 4 and 6 cups of filling. 6 cups will give you a nice round high pie, which is really beautiful. And so I start in the fall. You know, I love to bake pies in the fall because it's starting to get cold, and that's when I really want to turn the oven on. And I start with the first fall fruits, apples and pears, and that's the base. And then from there, I just add whatever else I want to add, and I let my appetite guide me. As long as I have 6 cups of filling, it's going to work.
So you can season any way you want, right?
Exactly. I mean, do you like cinnamon? Do you like ginger? Do you like both? Throw them in your pie. Do you want to put apples and pears and raisins and cranberries is what I used. And I use that combination because I had them. I had the apples and pears. I always keep raisins in my cupboard. And I had cranberries in my freezer left over from last Thanksgiving. I thought, all right, well, hey, let's put those in the pie too.
Do you always need a thickener, you think, when you're working with fruits?
Usually you do need a thickener. You know, the cranberries have some pectin in them, so that'll make it a little bit thicker.
Right.
But you do need a little bit of flour, cornstarch, or tapioca, depending on what kind of consistency you want. I think tapioca is probably the most neutral in flavor, but it's hard to find those little minute tapiocas in the supermarket. So sometimes if you don't want to try to seek that out, cornstarch works really well. A little bit of flour works well. Just something to absorb the juices so that when you cut the pie, they don't run all over the place.
So if you've got 6 cups of filling, how much do you need of the cornstarch, let's say, or the flour?
This is the only tricky thing about improvising your pie. It depends on how juicy your fruit is. If you are using apples and pears, they're less juicy than, say, ripe summer berries or plums or peaches, which, you know, are really very juicy.
Yeah.
The range is about between 2 tablespoons and 1/4 cup. For that kind of thing, you might look on the back of the tapioca box or look on the back of the cornstarch box. They'll actually give you a little guideline of how much you want to use. But you've got to do it to taste. I like my pies on the runny side. I don't know about you, Lynn, but when I cut it, if the juices run all over the place and if I'm serving it with ice cream, I've got a whole little sauce going on right there, which I just love. But some people like their pies to slice without any juice. So you have to know what kind of pie you're looking for.
One thing you do in this apple pear pie recipe that I really like is you do a streusel topping, which means I don't have to fool around with the top crust of the pie. This is so much easier to do.
I love streusel toppings because here's the thing about a pie. You've already got that flaky crust underneath. So you have that texture and you have that experience of eating a flaky pie crust. Then you've got your melting soft fruit. And if you do a streusel topping, you have yet another texture. You have the nubby, crunchy, nutty streusel. So I think it's just a more satisfying pie in general.
It's great. Hey, Melissa, thank you.
Happy baking.
Melissa Clark is the author of Cook This Now,
Melissa's infamous 20-ingredient pie can be found on the website splendidtable.org. Out to new places, it's not hard to pick up some cultural information so that we don't embarrass ourselves. But for some reason, we don't put tipping in that category. And we don't carry the latest tipping rules in our heads. Well, there is one man who does. Travel and Leisure's international editor Mark Orwell joins us. Mark, welcome.
Hey, thank you very much for having me here, Lynn.
So, Mark, is there a general rule that you can follow about tipping around the world?
A general rule?
Yeah.
That's like saying, can you describe a general meal around the world or a general restaurant around the world? Not really. There are some places, Lynn, where they're not going to expect any tip at all. There are other places where 20% is becoming more or less the average. And then you've got everything in between with a lot of little nuances in each individual country. So it's tough to generalize.
Well, is there any place where tipping is actually an insult?
Well, it's interesting you ask. It used to be considered an insult in French Polynesia as recently as 20 years ago. If you were to leave payment for service, they would literally take it as an insult.
Huh.
Now, that has changed. And in French Polynesia, the restaurants at the hotels and resorts will usually tack on a service charge. It's still uncommon to pay cash as a tip, or if a service charge isn't included, to leave an extra tip on the table. But no, these days it might not be normal in some places,
mm-hmm.
but very rarely will anyone consider it a flat-out insult.
Okay, I want to get into some specifics. For instance, it used to be in Europe that you rarely left a tip because the tip is included in the bill, and you might leave a little something extra if the service was extraordinary. Is that still the case?
Well, it is, in the sense that some countries, particularly France and Italy, routinely add a service charge. It's usually around 10%.
Mm-hmm.
In those cases, you might want to, if it was good service, tack on an extra 5% on top of that service charge. Elsewhere in Europe, about 10% is, you know, at your discretion. If you left between 5 and 10%, you wouldn't be, you know, they wouldn't throw things at you as you left the restaurant.
Yeah, yeah.
But the reason for this, Lynn, is very simple. It's not as high as it is in the United States, that is the percentages, because in both Western Europe and in Eastern Europe, the servers are paid a living wage. Whereas in the United States, I read a figure that said the average waiter or waitress in the United States earned about $4.81 an hour paid by the restaurant. The rest of it, they were dependent on tips.
On tips,
so you can
yeah.
imagine why tipping, the percentage is greater in the United States as opposed to somewhere like Europe where the waiters aren't dependent on the tips. It's just a little something extra for them.
Well, okay, let's talk about Asia. Now, Japan, do you tip or you don't tip?
You don't tip.
Oh.
If you wanted to leave a little something, you could. But, you know, there are instances in Japan where the server has actually taken the tip off the table, followed that customer outside onto the sidewalk and tried to return it as if perhaps they had forgotten their change. It is not customary to tip in Japan.
Now, are they adding a service charge to the bill in Japan?
Generally not. Now, I have noticed, though, a lot of chain hotels, the restaurants and chain hotels, increasingly are adding service charges, whether or not it's the norm in that country, as if it's an international norm,
right.
so to speak. So, but generally speaking, no. The whole idea of a service charge or a tipping in Japan or China, for that matter,
mm-hmm.
or even Thailand, Singapore, another one, tipping is not customary in these places.
So you can generally say a lot of Asia, you don't tip.
And even beyond that, Lynn, I can also say that where you're not expected to tip, if a tip is expected, like in Hong Kong or India, it's basically a service charge being added on to your bill. So you're covered in any event.
Ah, what about Mexico?
Mexico is very, very similar to the United States, not quite as high. The percentage there over the years has drifted upwards. And this is also true of the Caribbean. the percentage of a tip has drifted upwards from what used to be 10% to now 15% is very average. The thing you want to remember, though, if you are dining at a restaurant, whether it's in the Caribbean or in Mexico, the service tends to be a lot more relaxed. Food is served more slowly. You might literally have to look around, wave your arm, and try and flag down a waiter if you want to get a refresher drink or something like that. You shouldn't take that into consideration and leave a lesser tip because of it. That's just the way things are done there. But 15% in Mexico, in the Caribbean, you're going to be covered. You're going to be fine, and everyone will be happy with that.
Mark, thanks so much for all of this. Good to talk
Lynn,
to you.
Lynn, it's always great. Thanks for letting me be here.
Mark Orwall is international editor of Travel and Leisure magazine. It's hard keeping up these days. It used to be a lot easier. I mean, when I was a fledgling cook in New York, the first rule I learned was read Craig Claiborne every week. Now, that meant by the New York Times. Claiborne was its food editor and restaurant critic. And he was the person who got the food snobs over the idea that if it wasn't French, it wasn't worth eating. He would interview master home cooks, be they Mexican or Chinese or Indian. And I have to tell you, a lot of the trends that we see as new now, they began in his typewriter. In fact, he even changed publishing in the 50s and the 60s. Book editors would read Claiborne's interviews, and then they'd sign up those master home cooks. Well, Craig Claiborne was born and raised in Sunflower, Mississippi. He died in 2000 at 79. Southern food historian John T. Edge has traced his legacy. John T., welcome.
Thanks, Lynn.
John T., Craig Claiborne. You know, this is a name most people really don't know these days, but he was a pretty important guy when it came to food.
He was. I started thinking about his legacy when I read David Camp's book, The United States of Arugula. And Camp spoke of the import of Julia Child, the import of James Beard, and, yeah, the import of Craig Claiborne. I mean, here was a guy from Sunflower, Mississippi, raised in the Delta town of Indianola, who rose to be the food page editor of the New York Times, the first male food page editor of a major daily, and held that post for almost 30 years. He changed food journalism, to be sure, and changed how we saw food in America. And yet, his name is not on the tips of our tongues, and it should be. He was at the top of his field during that true transformation of American culinary culture, and he led so much of it. Claiborne was an early and honest champion of ethnic cuisines, what we might, you know, at that point have called ethnic cuisines, and now we call world cuisine, or now we call everyday cuisine. You know, Claiborne traveled to Vietnam to taste pho and make sense of pho.
The soup, the famous soup from Vietnam.
Yeah. He championed folks like Zarella Martinez and Paul Prudhomme and Bill Neal and all these kind of titans of American cookery. Claiborne was the kingmaker for so many of those folks.
He wrote about Diana Kennedy when she came out with her book on Mexican food back in, I guess, the 1970s. Nobody, on the East Coast at least, had a clue what Mexican food was. And, you know, here he's raving about this woman as a cook. And it made her a star.
He made so many stars. We held the Southern Foodways Alliance, the organization I direct. We held a panel recently wherein Jacques Pepin, David Camp, and then Pete Wells, who now holds Claiborne's post at the Times, kind of talked about Claiborne's legacy. And Pepin recognized that kind of minting of the great American cook that Claiborne did. But he also recognized that, you know, Claiborne kind of catalyzed, you know, the modern cooking accessory and equipment boom, that when Claiborne said, you must go out and buy this thing, whether it's a grater or a food mill or whatever it might be, that, you know, everything at Williams-Sonoma or that day's equivalent flew off the shelves. He taught America to fall in love not only with cookery, but with the utensils of cookery.
Yeah, I remember making $90 a week and spending half of that on a pot that he recommended. But did you know what he was like? I mean, what his personal life was like?
Well, he wrote this memoir, A Feast Made for Laughter, which was an early culinary memoir. If we are very familiar with that form now, Claiborne really broke ground with his. And his was a memoir of growing up, of his mother running a boarding house. And you think James Beard came out of a boarding house atmosphere, too,
yeah,
which
did.
Is kind of interesting. You know, he wrote of the African-American cooks that toiled in his mother's kitchen. He paid homage to them. He wrote of his Southern upbringing and of a fairly worldly Southern upbringing, and continued his story all the way through his times, tenure, and the like. But he wrote a pretty raw memoir. He wrote about his own kind of dark times. He wrote about his struggles with his sexuality. He wrote a tell-all memoir before it was hip to write a tell-all memoir.
You know, the thing I remember most vividly about him, there was a famous French restaurant in New York that he had reviewed, and he could make or break a restaurant. I mean, he was the most powerful food critic in the United States at that time. And he went back and re-reviewed it several years later, and he felt it was slipping. And one of the signs that it was slipping was that the butter was the wrong temperature.
Well, he brought such a rigor to restaurant reviewing. You know, he took restaurant reviewing kind of out of the pat-on-the-back gutter and put it on a pedestal and said, if you seek the stars of the New York Times, here is the level at which you should cook. Here is what, you know, how you should comport yourself. And that was unique for the time. You know, in a time when television didn't matter as much to our lives, Claiborne was the guy. Claiborne was the go-to guy. I think what has happened is, because of the good work of the James Beard Foundation, we know Beard.
Right.
Because certainly of Nora Ephron's great movie, we know Julia Child. But there has not emerged a mechanism by which we refamiliarize ourselves with Craig Claiborne. What we're doing at the Southern Foodways Alliance is we've renamed our Lifetime Achievement Award as a way of recognizing him both as a Mississippian, as a Southerner, but also as a seminal figure in American culinary culture. And I think it's, you know, he's due.
He paved the way. John T., thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure, Lynn.
John T. Edge is director of the Southern Foodways Alliance at the University of Mississippi. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. And the question is, what's the ideal gift for the paranoid coffee drinker? Start musing. We're going to be back with that answer in a moment, and we're going to be talking with you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking to you in a moment, but first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's an ideal gift for the paranoid coffee drinker? Well, for the coffee lovers who fret that their decaf is not decaf, assurance lies in the new decaf test strips. Well, assurance at least to a certain point. You know, most decaf coffees still have caffeine. Now, the strips react if the caffeine is over 20 milligrams per 6 ounces of coffee. Regular coffee's caffeine can range from 18 milligrams to a whopping 150 milligrams of caffeine in a cup. Hey, I mean, you could pass around strips with after-dinner coffee, but only with straight coffee. Because if you've done it with a double mocha hazelnut Taroni extra foamy, unfortunately, the syrups and the milk will confuse the strip.
Hello? Hey, what's going on? How come I never see you around no more? Where you been? Yeah, well, you should call me. When? Well, I get all my messages. I never got any from you.
Let's you and me talk. You can reach us 800-537-5252. Send an email. Just go to splendidtable.org or check us out on Facebook. We have Gary calling from Dubuque. Gary, what do you want to talk about?
Hey, great to talk to you. My wife and I are in the process of buying a half a cow.
Uh-huh.
And it's some great beef, and the people that process it are quite flexible, but I don't know the language to advise them with. And I know I've got a couple of concerns. You know, I've heard that cold aging or dry aging or whatever it's called, where it hangs in the meat locker, is
right.
really good, but I don't know how long to ask for. And then I don't want to lose anything good to the cutting room floor, you know?
Yeah.
I want to be able to experiment with tongue and cheek and things that you've talked about like that in the
right.
show before.
Yeah.
I do a lot of braising, so I want to maximize roasts for braising.
Mm-hmm.
So what do I say?
It's a good question. All right, first of all, you want the meat aged for about 3 weeks. I'm not sure of the temperature and humidity, and those are the two key things, but you don't want it aged in plastic, because a lot
yeah.
of times, you know, they'll take the primal cuts, the big cuts of the steer, and they'll just put them in cryovac, and they'll tell you that the meat has been aged. That's sitting in its own juices. What
right.
aging does is it dehydrates the meat, and it also gets enzymes going that really make it taste delicious.
Mm-hmm.
So you want it hung, and these people, if they do any kind of aging at all, they're going to know it.
Yeah.
But you want it about 3 weeks.
Okay.
Now, you're going to lose some weight with that as well.
Sure.
You know, you're going to pay for weight, and then it's going to be lost. And
right.
they're going to have to trim off, you know, mold and crustiness develops, and that's not harmful, but they have to trim all that off. So you're
sure.
going to have loss. Now, which half have you got? Is it a long half? You know, are you getting the animal is divided from
yeah.
nose to tail? Okay. You want them to keep for you the hanger steak.
Hanger steak.
You want the skirt steak.
Yes, I love skirt steak.
Yes. You want to have the flank steak.
Mm-hmm.
You want the belly, the short ribs.
Yeah. If you get short ribs, you don't get beef bacon and vice versa, and I'm a short ribs guy.
Yeah. You want the ribs. You want the bones. You also want the shanks. The best stew comes from the leg of the animal, believe
okay.
it or not. Okay? So you don't want them to skip giving you the shanks.
Okay.
And then you want those cheeks, and you want the tongue and the liver. And the other thing is that you want to ask them to take the chuck, which is the shoulder, and you want them to cut it into a 7-bone pot roast. Okay.
Okay.
A chuck arm roast. Now, these are then things you're going to cut up to make burgers or whatever, or you can just cook them whole.
Yep.
And then what you want them to do is to dress out the entire top loin, because the top loin is where the great steaks come from.
Okay.
Okay.
And when you say dress it out, what does that mean?
That means cut that top loin as a solid piece of meat. With no bone in it, because then you have got the option, okay, of slicing it into steaks or treating it as an entire roast, which could be stunning.
Yeah, although I'm thinking, you know, if I'm going to get it frozen after they're
oh,
done.
All right. All right. If they're going to be freezing it, then you want them to cut that in 1.5-inch thick steaks.
Okay.
Nothing thinner than that.
Yep.
Now, the rib area is the other area that's utterly prime.
Right.
Now, you can have part of that cut as a rib roast. That could be, you know, a big holiday treat, that kind of thing.
Sure.
And then you could have the rest of it cut into thick steaks. And then you do want the bones.
Okay.
And oh, I forgot to tell you, you want the shank cut into 2-inch thick slices across the bone.
Okay.
That is going to give you some of the most phenomenal stew you'll ever eat in your life.
Okay.
The bone, the marrow, and the meat.
Everything.
And you want the neck, because the neck is going to also give you phenomenal stew meat.
Okay.
So that's the basic idea.
Great.
I think you're going to do well.
Yeah, we're going to have a happy year.
Oh, you're going to have a very good year. Hey, enjoy it.
Yeah, wonderful advice. Thank you.
You are welcome, sir.
Okay.
Take care, Gary.
Bye-bye.
Sally's on the line from Seattle. Hey, Sally, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn.
Hello.
Hi. I have a wonderful 70-year-old Gravenstein apple tree. And normally what I do is I take the apples and I put them in a basket out by the side of the street for my neighbors.
That's
well,
generous.
This year I decided to make apple butter, and do you know I've put up 40 pints of apple butter, and I don't know what to do with it all. I've given it away to neighbors But I'm just wondering if you have any more ideas besides spreading it on toast for me.
Oh, yeah. And the other thing is just think all your holiday gifts are taken care of. And every time you're invited to someone's house, you know exactly what you're going to bring.
Oh, I know.
You're done for the year, you know. Okay, let's think. How would you use apple butter? Let me think. All right. So you bake a simple cookie. And it could be something like a ginger snap, or it could be a sugar cookie or whatever. And you bake them small, you know, in rounds.
Yeah.
And then you sandwich them with the apple butter.
That sounds great.
And, you know, I mean, what could be bad, right? And the other thing is that you can build like a stack cake with the apple butter, you know, where you have thin cakes or even make crepes. And you spread apple butter in between each. And wait a minute. How about making homemade really buttery biscuits? Take the apple butter and spread it on the warm biscuit and then top that with whipped cream, and then put
the lid on
the biscuit and put more apple butter on and top that with whipped cream.
Oh my gosh, I'll have to wear my expando pants.
I think it could be fabulous. And you know what? Oh. You could make a tart crust and make like a cream cheese cheesecake filling for it. You know, cream cheese,
right.
Sour cream, sugar, lemon, vanilla, an egg, and pre-bake the crust lightly and then spread apple butter over the bottom of it. Pour in that sort of cheesecake batter, right, and bake it. And when you cut into it and you get that layer of luscious apple butter.
Oh, that sounds divine.
And then with savory things, you could mix that apple butter with something tart. Okay, vinegar, garlic, right? And
really?
Garlic. Yeah.
Okay.
And now you have a glaze for anything, chicken, pork. You name it.
Oh.
It's sweet, sour, and garlicky, and you could throw hot stuff into that if you wanted to. And you know what else you could do with the apple butter? You could make a chutney. Take green apples, tart apples,
okay.
And raisins, and onion, and I guess garlic, and whatever seasonings you like. And you could simmer those in with the apple butter and apple cider until you get kind of a chutney. And you, as I said, season it however you want. Fresh ginger, that kind of thing.
Oh,
now you've got a condiment for sandwiches and all sorts of things.
Oh, thank you so much.
You are welcome, Sally. Enjoy it. 40 pints,
oh,
that's
will
dynamite.
Do.
You take
will
care.
Do. Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
You can reach us. Go online, splendidtable.org, or 800-537-5252. We've got Rich calling from Rochester, New York. Rich, welcome. What do you want to talk about?
Well, years ago, I learned through direct experience that spaghetti sauce just was not made for spaghetti squash. Well, of course, since then, we've joined a local farm. And, you know, we've gone out and put our fingers into the organic dirt, pulling weeds. And,
right.
So, you know, now we've got a spaghetti squash in our share, and somehow it's invested with that much more value. And I'd really like to do something with this squash that would make it shine and, you know, really bring out the best qualities of the squash.
Well, okay, so here's the thing about spaghetti squash. It has fibers that when you bake it, you can actually, with forks, kind of pull it apart, and it looks like spaghetti. But it's pretty tasteless.
Uh-huh.
Which brings to mind the thought of if you marinated it, since it has very little character of its own, it would be like a sponge. I mean, wouldn't it be interesting to try a spaghetti squash salad, but use as a model something like an Asian slaw? I think Asian because I think of those aggressive flavors. If you had fresh ginger and some rice vinegar and a little bit of garlic and then some jicama, you know, it has real crunch, so it'd be a contrast, and maybe some thin slice colorful peppers. And you would do a dressing maybe that's ginger and garlic and soy sauce with a little bit of sugar and a dash of sesame oil. And
maybe a little mirin.
A mirin would be fabulous. The rice wine with a bit of sweetness in it, that would be wonderful. And then you let that marinate. And then you can toss in there fresh coriander leaves for color. But the basic idea is treat the squash like a noodle in that it does not have a lot of flavor, but it will absorb stuff. and serve it at room temperature.
So I'm thinking when I pull the squash out of the oven it's nice and hot and I'm scooping it out of the shell, that's when I want to hit it with the marinade while it's hot to penetrate better.
That's when you want to hit it because it's going to pick up that flavor more quickly. And then you can just let it sit with the marinade, which could literally be any dressing you like. But I'm just leaning toward Asian flavors because, you know, I love them. But treat the squash the way it really wants to be treated, which is as a carrier for many great flavors and celebrate it in all its neutral glory.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you. Take care, Rich.
Bye.
Wendell Jameson is a new player in the game of what to drink with what. Now, his day job is city editor of the New York Times, but it's what happens on his living room couch that we want to know about. Wendell, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You are welcome, sir. And about that couch and those pairings, why don't you explain how they come together?
Oh, you know, my wife and I watch movies in the evening, and I'm a big movie fan going back from the days in the late 70s when my dad would take me to revival houses around New York. And I have all sorts of sort of obscure interests in movies, especially Japanese movies I've always loved.
Uh-huh.
And I began somewhere thinking about what I would drink with each movie that I watch, and that I will have a cocktail or a beer or a glass of wine that somehow mixes with the movie. It just almost became a little game in my own head, and then it became somewhat more obsessive as the years went by.
So what drives the matches?
Obviously, if it's a foreign movie, the easiest thing to do is match it with a drink from that country. It creates sort of a sensory experience. If it's a movie which has lots of drinking in it, it's an even easier comparison. For example, Benjamin Button, the Sazerac is an important
plot
point.
Yeah, the New Orleans cocktail.
The Sazerac, which is, you know, a little absinthe and rye and a little bitters and a piece of lemon peel. So I will say it goes quite well with that movie and its sort of dreamy quality and its sort of backwards narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But that's sort of obvious. So, you know, with a samurai movie, I tried sake for the first time, but that didn't really work. Sake is very sort of has a mellowing effect on me. And soju, which is a barley Japanese liquor, is much stronger and does create far more violent, energetic impulses in one than sake does. And it goes well with a very harsh black and white Japanese movie. You can't overdo it, obviously.
Yeah.
If you drink too much, the movie becomes completely nonsensical. But if you just time
you
it
do.
Just right,
yes.
It's very relaxing, and you get a lot out of it.
You know, this in some ways is much more interesting than wine and food because you're dealing with mood, you're dealing with story arcs.
Absolutely.
Let's try something. I'm going to name a movie, and you'll tell me what you drink with it.
Okay.
All right.
Now, all right.
The first one is a cream puff. Eat, Pray, Love.
Well, you know, I haven't seen Eat, Pray, Love. It's really not my kind of movie. I'm sure it's very good. I understand there's many scenes in Italy eating pasta, so a nice Italian white wine. My wife is from Basilicata. Well, I don't believe the movie goes to Basilicata, but we spent a summer there several years ago, and there's some very nice reds and crisp whites from that part of the country. So that comes right to mind.
So that's a wine movie. Okay.
I think that's clearly a wine movie. Maybe a rosé movie.
Well, all right. I've got an oldie. The original Cape Fear.
Ooh, that's a good movie.
That's a dark,
I would drink
dark...
a straight rye with Robert Mitchum tormenting my family. A straight rye or a straight bourbon.
Uh-huh.
So I would drink something straight and strong and bracing with that.
All right. Now, I'm going to switch you to television.
All right.
Glee.
We watch Glee. I don't drink with Glee, now that you mention it. I don't know. Maybe everyone's in high school. Is it appropriate to drink with so many under 18-year-olds in the room with you? I don't drink. I guess it feels like a beer, like a Budweiser kind of a show. I mean...
Well,
I drink when I was that age, blackberry brandy. I drank too much of that once, and I never touched that stuff again. a screwdriver? I don't know. Yeah, I guess a beer.
Okay.
Funny, it doesn't make me want to drink. I enjoy that show a lot.
Wendell, thank you. You've opened up a whole new set of possibilities for us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Wendell Jameson is city editor of the New York Times. Well, that's our show. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can get to us anytime. You have a great week. And let me leave you with this definition from Ernie Kovacs, who said, television, a medium, so-called because it is neither rare nor well done. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. You will find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Check out our series of special podcasts called How to Eat Weekends, based on our new book of the same name, as well as our new blog. You're going to find it all there, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson and Mary Beth Leone Gettin. Our technical director and editor is Jennifer Lubke. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We'll be back next week. You have a great one. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.